This talk is brought to you by iBiology.org, and this audio was taken from a video available on our website.
Listen carefully. Can you hear that? Before I went to the jungle of Borneo, nobody had ever recorded this calling behavior before. But before I introduce you to my friend here, let me take you through the journey of how I made this discovery and what it means for the understanding of mating systems and animal behavior in general. Frogs have evolved amazing structures for sound production. They may call alone or in choruses, but the idea is to attract the female, and the female is listening very carefully to what they have to say. In general, the male calling behavior has two functions. First, they are trying to attract the females, but at the same time, they are trying to keep other competitors at bay. If the female is convinced of the attractiveness of the male based on the acoustic characteristics of its call, then she's going to approach him and mate with him. However, you may think, does the female say something? And the answer is, most of the time, no. The female frogs do not have spontaneous vocal behavior like the males do. Biologists have been fascinated by the differences between females and males since the beginning of time. In the case of frogs, like this couple right here, you may not even know which one is the female and which one is the male. Sometimes you can tell by the size, but there are not traits that are obvious to the naked eye, if you will. In other species, though, males have weapons, like antlers, that they use to combat with other males for access to the females. In other species, males have flashy and colorful feathers that they use for displays that are attractive to the females, and the females may discriminate among the males and choose the most beautiful one. So, in frogs, the answer to what makes males and females different is going to be their voice. Most of the time, if you hear a frog calling in your backyard or in a nearby pond, chances are that it's going to be a male. But at the end, it doesn't matter what they use, antlers, feathers, beautiful songs. If you want to think about it as a rule of thumb, males are the ones that display and females are the ones that choose. I'm a herpetologist, and I'm interested in amphibians and reptiles. Mostly, I'm interested in the reproductive behavior of frogs. I'm interested in their calling behavior, because that's how they get their mates. And I'm also interested in what happens after they get their mates. What happens with the babies? What kind of strategies they have developed to take care of their offspring? Particularly, I'm fascinated with the larval transport behavior in frogs. Many species of frogs evolve to lay the eggs on land. But this poses a problem of where is the water for the tadpoles? So again, these species have evolved this amazing larval transport behavior where the tadpoles climb on the back of the male or the mother, and they catch a piggyback ride to small bodies of water where the male or the female can deposit them and they can finish their development and become adult frogs. This particular behavior has been observed in many species of poison dart frogs in Central and South America, where I'm from. Scientists have been studying these species for decades. They have been figuring out how they lay the eggs, how they transport the tadpoles, and how do they find the places to deposit the tadpoles. However, if you go to the other side of the world, almost nothing is known about species that have this particular parental care. In fact, there's only two species that so far have been reported to have this parental care behavior. And nothing has been done in terms of figuring out what they do. They may not look like that colorful as the poison dart frogs that I showed you before, but I can assure you that they are equally, if not more, interesting. And in fact, this guy over here became the focus of my research. Let me introduce you to the guardian frog of Borneo, Limnonectes palamanensis. This nocturnal leaf-litter frog, about an inch long, lives exclusively on the island of Borneo. Populations of these species are distributed mainly in the north and the west part of the island. And the first report of larval transport was made in 1986. A couple of years later, in 1988, the first report of a male guarding the eggs was made. But since then, a little bit over 30 years ago, nothing else has been studied about these species. And it has become a blank slate for me to do research in larval transport behavior. So when I knew about this, it was an obvious decision for me to go from Connecticut all the way to Borneo to study the parental care behavior of these species. My research took place particularly at the Ulu Temburong National Park in Brunei Darussalam. In the middle of the rainforest, there was So whenever I heard that sound, I would make a beeline for it because I knew a male was waiting for me to be recorded. I recorded many males like this, and I wanted to get as many males as possible. And it was in one of these many nights recording a male where I heard a sound that I wasn't particularly familiar with, and I didn't know where it was or what it was. Remember our friend from the beginning? So this is a frog that belongs to the species of the guardian frog. And if this is the male calling, so what is this? After careful observation, I noticed that this is actually a female calling. This is a very particular, unique behavior in frogs because females do not produce spontaneous calls. It is very interesting that nobody had ever recorded this behavior before because females, even though have a very short and soft call, they are calling. And one of the reasons why I think nobody had ever reported this before is because scientists for the longest time thought that only male frogs were capable of producing sounds. So having a male calling started creating a lot of questions in my head about what's happening in these species. In general, in species that have male parental care, unique traits on the females, like in this case, female calling behavior, are usually associated with a mating system that is called sex role reversal. So we know that the guardian frog has male parental care, and they have this female calling behavior. These two things together are key for the occurrence of this mating system. So could it be that the guardian frog of Borneo is a sex role reverse species? But before I answer this question, let me tell you a little bit more in detail what a sexual reverse species is. In this species, the males are the ones providing all the parental care, and the females exhibit traits that are normally only associated with the males. In addition, the females are going to use those traits to display more vigorously than the males do. And also, the females that are ready to mate are going to be more abundant than the males that are ready to mate, because this is going to create a shortage of males available for mating. This is going to create the possibility of female-female competition. Species like the seahorses and pipefish and a handful of birds have been reported to have sexual reversal. This has also been observed in insects, but so far, it has never been reported in frogs. If the guardian frog of Borneo is a sexual reverse species, we would expect that several aspects, if not all of them, of the natural history of this species match the conditions for sexual reversal to occur. So far, we know that males provide all the parental care, taking care of the eggs and transporting the tadpoles to small bodies of water. And I have discovered that the females exhibit this spontaneous female calling, which you would normally only associate with male frogs. So this begs for the other questions. Do females display more vigorously than the males? And are the females more abundant than them? And ultimately, do they compete against each other for mating opportunities? The fact that the females call spontaneously was a stroke of luck because it allows me to compare the calling rate of males and the calling rate of females. The calling rate is defined as the number of times a frog, in this case, produces a call within a given period of time. So throughout the night, I would record how many times a female produced a call within an hour and how many times a male produced a call within an hour. And I did this throughout the night for many different individuals. In this figure, we have in the x-axis the time, and the y-axis is showing us the calling rate. This is the calling rate of the males. If we compare this with the calling rate of the females, we can see that even though there's a lot of variation throughout the night, the females, on average, call way more than the males do. Males call once every 10 minutes, while the females do it 30 times every 10 minutes. This data allows me to check off this condition that the females display more vigorously than the males. For our next question, I wanted to see how many males were available for mating and how many females were available for mating. Males of the guardian frog are widely dispersed throughout the forest. Now we know that the males don't call that often, but when they do, they're attracting females to their location. I observe how females venture through the forest, homing in on the call of these males. And I observe that sometimes two, three, and in a few exceptional cases, four females would gather around specific male and start calling spontaneously as if serenading him. These females form these particular aggregations that had never been observed in other species of frog. I found that almost 50% of the time, every time you encounter a male calling, he was going to have two or more females around him. So if you compare how many males that are calling are available for mating and how many females, you can see that females are more abundant than the males. This is evidence that is concordant with the criteria of females being more abundant than the males. For our next question, do females compete among them for mating opportunities? I'm going to have to leave you with a cliffhanger than maybe. During my time in the forest, I never observed females competing physically for the calling male, but competition can take place in many different ways. Because the females call and call so vigorously, there is the potential for acoustic competition. And there's also the potential for the male to discriminate among two different females, behaving as the choosy sex. If these two things happen in these species. This would provide further evidence that this species is actually sex role reversed. And I hope to answer this and other questions with my future research, trying to determine if females react to a simulated competitor with playback experiments. And I would also like to see if males have preferences for acoustic characteristics of the female calls, and if they can discriminate and choose between two females. So far, my research has laid the ground for this species to be the first case of sex role reversal in frogs, and to be the first frog to actually join this iconic group of species that have sex role reversal. Studying these systems that go against to what we actually think is conventional challenges our understanding of how animal systems work. This little frog has been around for many years, and nobody had studied it. And it took one person to take the time and to make careful observations about this behavior to discover what they have to tell us. I want to call the attention to the importance of doing natural history studies and behavioral studies, because there's so much more that we have to learn and so much more to discover. So for now, I hope that in the meanwhile, you keep your ears open, because there may be a frog or a bird or maybe another creature that you don't even know produces a sound that is just waiting to make its voice heard.
Visit us at iBiology.org for more free talks from the world's top scientists. This talk was brought to you with support from the National Science Foundation, the National Institute of General Medical Sciences, and the Lasker Foundation.